coming out, everybody. This is a great crowd. Very exciting. Yeah. Give yourselves a round of applause. I'm Andy. I'm part of Woodbine. Tonight, we're going to be talking with Jamie Merchant. He's here from Chicago to talk to us. He's the author of Endgame, Economic Nationalism and Global Decline. So I thought, you know, we would start off by talking a bit about the book. A large part of the book is about capitalist stagnation, capitalist crisis, the declining rate of profit, perhaps. Maybe we'll get into that. Controversial subjects. But then, you know, how that economic stuff leads to things like Trump, leads to things that are more on our minds politically. And it's not just Trump. It's not just the Republicans and Democrats in the elections, but we're seeing Trump-like figures all over the world. Epidemic of right populism. And we're going to hopefully move this conversation into a more open discussion. There's lots of us, so hopefully there'll be lots of ideas about what we're going to do over the next 4 years. Because, you know, we've just had these elections, and in many ways, the elections doesn't really change anything. But I think at least it'll give us a good space these next couple months to reconsider our politics, our activity, you know, our view of what's happening globally, what's happening in our own lives, and think about what we're going to do as people who don't just want to be depressed nihilists saying that we're fucked. Nothing wrong with that if that's how you feel, but we don't necessarily have to feel that way. And that's why I put up these images of January 20th, 2017. This was this massive black bloc in D.C. for Trump's first inauguration. I think right about now they're getting kind of kettled and owned, but besides that part, there were riots on K Street, like, until sundown. So it was an exciting day. It was, you know, the next day was the Women's March in D.C. and nationally, when millions of women and their allies came to the streets vowing to fight, you know, against Trump's right-wing patriarchal agenda. And there was that feeling of, like, this is going to be 4 years of real struggle. And in many ways, it was. I don't think we feel that way today, which is interesting. So maybe we're going to talk a little bit about resistance, or maybe we're going to be thinking about being political in a way that's different than resistance. So we're going to try to move that conversation in that direction. But I'll throw it to Jamie, and I'll actually open with a quote from his book to sort of tee things up. Today, the exhaustion of capitalist growth feeds a spreading sense of political paralysis and social crisis that prepares the way for leaders who will supposedly stand up to the evil globalists and their domestic subversives, whoever that may be on a given day. In some way, authoritarian rule is always based on the promise to bring the national family together again in the face of threats from above and below. Here's Jamie Merchant.
Thanks, Andy. It's funny that he picked that sentence to read from the book that mentions the drive of the authoritarian sort of impulse to restore the national family, because we were just at a panel where these people were arguing that the left needs to get serious about defending the nuclear family because it's under attack, and that's going to somehow be the way forward for the left. But I digress. So I'd be happy to talk about that more at length, but maybe we should, lay out some of the basic arguments of the book, and then that will give us a different perspective on our current moment, where we are now facing Trump the sequel. And like Andy mentioned, we don't have this mass sort of uprising in response to it, as we did in January 2017. There seems to be this overall, the energy just is not there, right? Whether it's the fact that people just feel exhausted, or resigned, or whatever it is, we're not seeing the same response, even from the center, right? Resistance liberalism is not a thing anymore. They seem also kind of resigned to the writing on the wall. And I mean, to me, nothing sort of demonstrated or illustrated the fecklessness of the Democratic claim that their whole strategy, right, in the election, which is based around the idea that they are not Trump. Trump is a fascist threat to democracy. He's an existential threat to the Republic and has to be stopped at all costs. Then, you know, after the election and Trump's victory, Joe Biden invites Trump to the White House, you know, to have a nice cup of tea or whatever by the fire, and to tell him they're going to help do everything they can, right, to make the transition for his team as smooth as possible. I think Trump said something like, it's going to be such a smooth transition, folks. You have no idea how smooth it's going to be. It's going to be so great. And I think it captures so well the, I mean, if I could use borrow a word from professional wrestling, the kayfabe of the whole endeavor, the whole spectacle, right? It's, they never took seriously this idea that he, I mean, if he's a fascist threat, if he's a real fascist threat to the Republic, why are they just, you know, complacently doing that? And so I think a lot of people sort of see through that and sort of see through the kayfabe. And by the way, I think Trump, say what? Oh, incorrect. Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there are some out there. Okay, sure. That's definitely fair. But a lot of people are definitely just exhausted with the whole affair at the political and electoral level. And so how do we get here, right? You'll find all kinds of explanations in the mainstream media, in, of course, left-wing media, right-wing media, that blame different victims, you know, especially on the right, you know, singling out scapegoats. The centrists now try to single out, you know, the so-called woke left as the people who are at fault, as they always do when they lose and fail. But the argument of the book is essentially that we're living through the aftermath of the failure of what people used to call globalization, which was this period from roughly the mid-80s to, let's say, 2008 and the great financial meltdown of that year, where the idea was that as long as we, you know, believe in the free market and liberal economic values, and we sort of break down governmental and state barriers to free trade all around the world, and we dismantle what, you know, when economists talk about labor market rigidities, just means like dismantling unions, basically. We follow that sort of program around the world, and we uphold the values of human rights and liberal democracy. And the narrative of globalization was that we're going to see this flowering of liberal democracy and the spread of human rights and sort of liberal values in economics and politics around the world as the global economy, the capitalist economy, continues to grow and continues to create wealth that leads to rising prosperity for the majority of people, including the working class. And that was going to be, there were going to be some technical issues to be figured out here and there, but the establishment's narrative was that this was the direction things were going in. And that narrative held very powerfully for a solid around 20 years. And then in 2008, we have a tremendous sort of cratering, like a global meltdown of the global financial kind of architecture that really sends the elites, the technocrats, and the kind of centrists, the custodians of capitalism and their political representatives, kind of scrambling because they didn't see it coming, and it completely surprised them in a lot of ways, and that led to a solid decade or more of depression and cratering incomes for the vast majority of workers, rising debt for the vast majority of workers, and just completely, it completely destroyed living standards for a huge number of people in this country and around the world. We then saw the crisis that began here, which in Europe, they initially were trying to isolate as just an American thing. The Germans in particular were trying to say that this is the result of the failures of American capitalism, and it's very hyper-financialized, and it's reckless and irresponsible. That's not how we do things in the EU. You know, we can be this new kind of model for this socially responsible capitalism. And they were able to make that argument for 1 or 2 years before the Eurozone was then completely smashed by the same crisis as it worked its way across the ocean and emerged in the Eurozone crisis of 2010, 2012, which ground on for years. And so this is happening for a decade or more. And it's during this period, of course, that we see the rise of figures like Trump, right? And in a way, Trump sort of was able to speak to the frustrations and the anger and the rage that this created in a way that the liberals would not, right? I mean, Hillary Clinton's campaign slogan in 2016 was America's already great or something like that. And then, I mean, this year, it was as if they hadn't learned anything, right? I think Kamala Harris's campaign, they were trying to emphasize the theme of joy at the end. Party over country, we're the party of joy. That just, it doesn't work if most people are pissed off and angry at their living conditions. And so we see Trump and these kinds of figures, right, who are now just a part of our life, these reactionary populist figures arising sort of in the 2015, 2016 period. And the 2016 election really, 2008 was a shock, but 2016, of course, when Trump won, was when the neoliberal elite, or what I would then call the neoliberal elite, really began to realize that something was going wildly wrong with their understanding of the world, right? That globalization narrative that I was talking about before, that it really was not working out the way they thought, right? And for several decades, one could make the argument, and I try to point out in the book that we had from 1990 again to around 2008, you could call it the kind of economist's ideal version of capitalism. It was based on, you know, all the politicians were trying to strengthen markets, strengthen freedom of trade, attacking unions, smashing workers' power, and doing everything they could to hand all power over the economy to capital and the capitalists. Despite that, we still have this tremendous pressure of stagnation and economic slowdown, like all around the world. When, you know, if you look at it in terms of what's happening macroeconomically with these things that I'm talking about, the liberalization of trade and so on, it should have been an era of tremendous economic growth, right? And that's what they thought it was supposed to be, but it wasn't. And so 2016 really, really shocked the elite, I think, and began to sort of shake them out of their complacency on some level. And then 2020 and the coronavirus crisis, again, the worldwide pandemic, and the massive, you know, historic uprising of the summer of 2020. And then I would also say January 6, 2021, this rapid succession of shocks really convinced the ruling class and their political representatives that something, they had to start doing something differently, that they had to start governing differently, that they had to start thinking about addressing the conditions that's producing this social instability and this volatility, right? And because I believe that period, like 2020 through 2021, I think it scared the shit out of them, actually. I think a lot of the political class and the ruling class, they felt the situation was getting out of their control a little bit during those years. And so I believe it's their response to that kind of sequence that led to the Biden administration's attempt to resurrect the idea of industrial policy in this country, which is another thing we can talk about if y'all are interested. But there's a new kind of consensus, at least among the Democratic Party elite, policy elite, that they have to throw what we used to call on the left neoliberalism, right? Throw that rule book out the window. They now have their own, that is to say the centrists now have their own critique of neoliberalism that they are drawing on to try to articulate this more state-powered, directly interventionist kind of economic policy. And so we saw that in three big bills or forms of legislation, the Infrastructure Act, the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, and the CHIPS Act, which is trying to divert, right, government resources, federal money into mostly semiconductor research and production in this country. And all of that is within this larger pivot to a more, what I would describe as a neo-Cold War foreign policy framework, which understands the United States as entering a new era of great power competition with other powerful countries on the global stage, most importantly China, but not just China, and the realization that they were going to have to start doing something differently if they wanted to avoid the instability and the economic depression that had kind of come about during the 2010s and as the kind of culmination, the dramatic culmination of the coronavirus crisis. And so in this country, you know, every country has their own narrative for blaming outside powers for their own internal failures. And in this country, you know, China is constantly victimized, demonized among the governing class.
for, and now increasingly even among the corporate elite, for destroying all of America's jobs, for destroying the economy, and for basically being mostly responsible for all of the shit that's been, the bad stuff that's been happening for the last 5 or 6 years or more. And so the turn to national industrial policy and this more belligerent foreign policy, you know, I argue are sort of two sides of the same coin. And in fact, I would even characterize what we're moving into now as kind of a form of state, a new kind of state capitalism that is based more directly on the need of private corporate capitalists or corporations, their dependency on increasingly extreme forms of state intervention in the market, in the economy, in order to remain profitable. As the larger global economy in which the United States and China and every other country is enmeshed continues to slow down and continues to stagnate, and investment in which investment rates continue to dry up, and income growth becomes more and more scarce, and we is sort of all pushing us more, pushing the world into a more zero-sum economic environment, where the perception, at least, is that growth for one country can only come at the expense of another. And as long as the power elite believes this, then we are on track for a very dangerous and destructive future, potentially, in which tensions and antagonisms between the most powerful countries in the world just continue to ratchet up, right? Because that's increasingly the perception among every country's ruling elite, that we are in this zero-sum environment, which again is the polar opposite of the globalization narrative, right? That the pie was going to get bigger, everyone was going to have a piece of the growing pie. Now it's getting smaller. And so, in my most pessimistic moods, I reach for analogies that go back to the early 20th century. Something kind of similar in terms of trade wars was happening, although in the context of direct imperialist competition. And so I think we now are in a new period of imperialist competition, but it looks very different from that kind of period of classical imperialism and colonialism, colonial domination. And I'm happy to, we can speculate a little bit if people are interested in what direction, all this is headed, if it's interesting later. But so that, by way of a very brief tour of recent events, is the argument of the book in a nutshell. It's capitalism is slowly dying globally. It no longer can produce the growth rates that it used to be able to. Governments have to work harder and harder and take more and more extreme measures to keep it going. So it's almost like a treadmill effect, right? They have to take more and more dramatic sort of interventions into the market economy and in corporate welfare and those kinds of policies, subsidizing private companies, in order to keep, just to keep it running, just to keep the private capitalist economy ticking over. And so because of that, we are now in basically a new era of state capitalism. That's what I would call it. And that tends to, historically, it hasn't been very good when globally things have been moving in this direction. And so anyway, there's a lot more to be said about like the domestic political consequences of all this and popular perceptions of what's happening, responses to it, and all of that. But that, I guess I'll leave it at that for the argument of the book.
Yeah, maybe following up with that, it's interesting to frame this right-wing trajectory towards state capitalism, because, of course, we have a faction of the incoming Trump administration who's got an almost anarcho-capitalist ideology. I just read this kind of horrifying piece by the Doge Commission today of Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, who they say, kind of following the part of the 2025 playbook, they're going to slash civil service, cut tons of federal spending. And their inspiration is Javier Milei in Argentina. Of course, on the other hand, Vivek is a venture capitalist guy, so is Elon Musk, and they owe their wealth to government spending. So do you think that this kind of libertarian or anarcho-capitalist facade, or do you think there's something to that, or do you think that it's kind of a different form of state capitalism? And then maybe along those lines, of course, I think what's on a lot of our minds in terms of what January and February are going to look like is Trump threatening to use the military or emergency powers to start this campaign of mass deportations of millions of people. Many of them are our friends, people who are involved in this space. So that's definitely something that's really terrifying to us. To me, this seems like it's pretty blatantly like a war on the working class, specifically the underclass, the people who do so much work in this country already at high rates of exploitation. And I think the premise of this, to me, how I interpret it is the rates of exploitation are going to get much higher because people are going to be so terrified of being locked up and going to some prison awaiting deportation. Maybe we can talk about after this question about state capitalism, what's the kind of the conception of class power or the rebalance of class power in Trump's proposed solutions to these economic problems that you point out?
I think Elon is interested in using like state power to the degree that they're actually able to do anything. They might just create like an app or something, and that'll be the end of it. Like, I think maybe, you know, they just created this Doge thing to make him go away and do that for a little bit, go away from the White House. But I think he's also interested in the possibility of using governmental power to like damage his rivals, his competitors. You know, it's a very typical oligarchic like preference. And I think he'll try to figure out some way to do that. Regardless, the subsidies and the sponsorship of the larger, for example, the financial system, the banking system in this country by the Federal Reserve, and the sort of collaboration between the Federal Reserve, the central bank, and the Treasury in order to keep the financial markets, you know, going up and asset values going up, that won't change, right? That form of whatever Elon and Vivek are going to do, that kind of corporate welfare is not going to change. They're going to continue to bail out, you know, banks and banking institutions if any sort of crises begin to bubble up in the financial markets. And that kind of direct intervention, right, is not going to change, because I think they've made the decision that doing everything, like it's imperative to keep asset values going up and to prevent an economic meltdown of the financial system, because the ruling, the technocrats who are the sort of the custodians of the economic system, they've learned a lot of tricks since 2008, since that major meltdown, and they have experimented in all kinds of new ways to make sure that the asset values that their livelihoods depend on, and that the strength of the dollar, the U.S. currency, which is crucial for U.S. geo-imperial power, remains strong. And so they will do everything they can to keep line going up, and that won't change, right? I think regardless, like whatever the Doge department is going to do. And yeah, I mean, the assault on working people is definitely coming. I think there are questions about how successfully is he going to do it, or how successfully will he be able to carry it out, Trump, that is, his administration. It's going to be a colossal expenditure, right? I've seen, I don't know, like tens of billions of dollars, this mass deportation program. And regardless of whatever happens, I think there's going to be a lot of it's going to be urgent to be looking out for comrades and loved ones and friends in our local communities and networks, and doing our best to organize to protect each other during this time, especially those who are more vulnerable. But there's also a chance, and this is also very dangerous, that it'll become an escalatory strategy for the Republicans, by which I mean Trump will issue some executive order that then is either tied up in courts or is not observed by Democratic governors, right, in blue states. Maybe even some Republicans will want to try to wash their hands of it. And the narrative will change to it's these traitors who are holding back the will of the people. We just won this big historic election, right? He did win the popular vote by the thinnest margin since like the 19th century or something is what I read. But they're going to be trying to sell it as this huge overwhelming victory, right? And so there is the chance that if his super reactionary ideas get blocked like that, it's going to turn into this very volatile back and forth and this narrative of blaming, right, the traitors and the dissidents and the betrayal, right, from inside. And in some ways, I mean, that's that's just as scary, right? And so we'll have to see. Right now, it's looking like his administration is going to be as sort of shambolic and incoherent, at least in the early stages, despite all the time they've had to prepare. But we'll see. It's still in the very early stages, and he does have a new group of ghouls around him. Some of the old characters, but also some new people who have some new ideas. And we don't know how effective they're going to be as organizers yet and as kind of like administrators. So we'll have to see. And how much they hate each other and, you know, like purge each other from the cabinet. And that all remains to be seen. But so anyway, yeah, that's how I would answer that question.
All right. I'll just ask one more question, then we can turn it over to the audience. So think about what you'd like to say or ask Jamie. So you said something just a moment ago that it's something I've heard a lot in the last couple of weeks, which is that we have to pay attention to the people around us and care about each other and figure out how we're going to protect each other. And I totally agree with this. This is, you know, I think always my conception of politics is on that level, the level of your home, your neighborhood, your workplace. This is where we can have the biggest effect. So this is how I always think about centering politics. But of course, it's not always that. We have larger ambitions of organizing citywide networks, national networks, international networks, making big changes. And so how the left usually talks about this task is, well, we have to go out and organize. And on one hand, yeah, of course, we have to organize. I think all of us organize in some way. My major project is here at Woodbine. You know, we have a food pantry that distributes food twice a week. We've got dinners every Sunday, open dinners. Tomorrow, there's a research group meeting before the dinner where we're talking about Marcuse. We've got film screenings and a mycology group and reading and writing groups, all kinds of stuff. I'm very proud of what we do here at Woodbine. I invite everyone to come by for these events. On the other hand, I feel like, you know, however strong this space is, we are very at the mercy of either external repression, you know, like there's some legislation that they could easily take away our nonprofit status that'll really jeopardize our funding model. Oh, by the way, there's a donation jar on the table if you'd like to chip in to help support the space so we can pay our rent. Or, you know, just internal pressure. There's a lot of ways this community can fall apart. So I think as we're organizing, both with these like broader political ambitions, but also just to protect one another and to have strong communities, we have to be thinking about this concept of anti-fragility. This is an idea that kind of pressure actually makes us stronger. Thinking about how we can organize in ways where we are dynamic enough and strong enough in terms of our bonds with each other that we can rise to these challenges. And I'll read one more quote from your book that I think gets us maybe towards the question of how we can expand this organizing and these concepts of solidarity larger. The exact shape of what is coming cannot be known in advance, and so neither can its name, if it is to have one. Regardless, everything hinges on the question of class consciousness, a question that extends beyond national boundaries to include those elsewhere with whom we share the idea of freedom. So I want to ask you, what do you mean when you say class consciousness? Is this simply like, I don't know, I think when the left talks about it, they're like, well, people just need to read Marx and understand what Marx's conception of class was. But I think you're talking about something different here. Yeah, so what does this mean to you?
Yeah, the easy question, class consciousness. How to do it. Like, to me, class consciousness just means workers, people who earn a wage for a living, identifying with each other on that basis in terms of a class position and feeling bonds of solidarity, affective and emotional, with each other on that basis. And so I think we have a big kind of conundrum that we have to figure out here, because to me, it's tied to the question of mass politics. And I think this gets at, Andy, what you were saying about kind of the larger scales, right, that we maybe should be entertaining when we think about organizing and political work. And the assumption, I think, during the 2010s and during the kind of social democratic campaigns of figures like Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn in the UK and like figures, was that if we can do left mass politics in this country if we just get the messaging right and if we like get the coalitions right. we can spark a social democratic or a mass democratic movement with a kind of class consciousness based on, you know, the billionaires versus the rest. Going back to Occupy, you know, we are the 99% versus the 1%. And the way I read that is that we sort of ran this political experiment twice in 2016 and 2020 with a candidate at the national level who had the bullhorn of national politics, who ran as a Democrat so that he could do that, with this exact message that we need to, you know, fight the billionaire class for the worker, for the working class. And in fact, he said working class, which is pretty rare in U.S. politics. Kamala was back to saying the middle class in her campaign, so that was like a very noticeable regression. But Sanders would talk about the working class. But of course, we didn't win. We didn't draw the majorities we needed, despite making that argument, disseminating that message, and doing it twice. So that theory of political change was falsified twice. And I don't think we have an alternate theory right now for mass politics. You know, I think that's a vacuum, theoretically and programmatically. And I mean, I'm very interested to hear what you all think about that, because I mean, I have my ideas, of course, about directions we could go in. But this is very much something we have to figure out together. And I don't think there's like a simple answer, right? And yeah, I'll just add, even Bernie Sanders, right? Today, I think it was today, he sent out a message that was like, well, the idea of working with the Democrats, that's over. So what are we doing now? And it's like, well, yeah, now he decides to say that. You know, better late than never. But that's there's a lot more, of course, I could say about that. But I think that...
Do you want to talk about the...
Sure. I mean, so... I don't know. My experience in the 2010s as a political organizer, probably maybe true for some of you as well, was very dominated. You know, I'm from Chicago, and I work within the community organizing tradition out there, which comes out of a certain, basically the main figure is Saul Alinsky, and the idea is that you are, you know, organizing with people one-on-one, you are canvassing, you're door knocking, you're doing phone banks, you're having conversations about the issues with people, and you're trying to point them in terms of their self-interest in a particular direction on a certain issue, to maybe support your candidate, right? Or support your issue or whatever it may be. And to me, I just always felt, even if it was a moderately successful, first of all, most, you know, if you've done canvassing, like actually talking to people sometimes can be pretty rare. Like a lot of people just don't open their doors. And I mean, when I get a phone call from a random number, I'm just immediately like, block, you know, like, I don't want to answer that. And so phone banking is very limited as well. And so it always felt like I've seen the expression used by some others, and I think it's very apt. It's like community organizing without community. It's like we were trying to stand up this mass socialist political campaign with a bunch of people who are isolated from each other and separated and maybe not in a social condition in which they feel like socialism is a real possibility for them. We could at least say that, or at least a real possibility in this country, right? And so, I mean, how do we get around that? And to me, I think part of the answer is civil social organizing that is based on forming associations and organizations, workers-led, workers-run, neighborhood, you know, community-rooted, that are embedded in people's everyday lives, are providing ideally useful services or resources to them, and that can serve as a vehicle to make socialist values real to people, right? And so it's not just this presidential candidate talking about, you know, democratic socialism or national healthcare or whatever it might be, but rather people experiencing what this looks like in their own lives, right? And that's about as far as I've gotten with it. And like I said, I'm definitely interested in hearing others' opinions on that. But I think we have to figure out how to do mass politics again. I think it has something to do with that, but I don't know exactly what it looks like.
Yeah, I totally agree. This is what I was getting at. My question is this link between the kind of work we're doing here at Woodbine and the work that the ILC is forming to do. I know we've got some ILC people here, so maybe we can hear more about that. Linking those kind of smaller, more humble projects, maybe community-based, maybe workplace-based, and trying to make a mass politics out of that. We're not really sure how to do that yet, but I think maybe the horizon of that is opening as the Democratic Party really delegitimizes itself again on a more drastic scale. But let's hear what some people here think. Maybe we can get a show of hands of everyone who has something to say. Lots of people. So how about this? If you have something really quick to ask, you can just, you know, shout it out. If you have something a little bit longer to say, I'll give you the mic. How's that sound? I think your hand was first. You want to take the mic?
So one model that, not to say the bad word, but anarchists use is the affinity group. And it's talking about grabbing people from your community and using that together, like make your immediate friends can and form a political group here and now. And it's a great way to kind of get the ball rolling. It's like, if you don't know your neighbors and, you know, if you're not willing to knock, then you can talk to all of your friends. I mean, there's no reason not to. And this is kind of like that first building block, that first step to having more than one person, because the last thing you want to do is like be on your own. And I think that's like the first building block is having an immediate group of people that can support you, because, you know, it's like they don't necessarily have to go knocking door to door with you or go campaigning, but you're going to have people who can like print things for you, people who can, you know, sign you up for something, service, steal from their work to get you the paper supplies you need. So the first, and I mean, my suggestion and my experience is just in the affinity group model is a great first step if you have really no idea where to go first. It's like that is just gives you a solid ground and it opens you up in terms of you now have a much larger bank of people to bounce ideas off of. So that was just what I wanted to contribute in terms of like a good first step for anyone who just has no idea where to start as you start in your immediate group. So that's just what I had to say.
Thank you so much. All right. I think you were next. You want to pick the mic? Okay. If you want, maybe we can start a line here if you want to get on the mic.
Hello. Yeah, my name is Jake. I'm a member of the Maoist Communist Union. We just put out an article like talking basically just about this stuff. So it's interesting to see other people are thinking about this. And we're calling it neo-mercantilism. There's probably some stuff, I think you call it like neo-Keynesianism. There's probably some stuff that the U.S. bourgeoisie is drawing from Keynes. But I don't know, you see Trump talking about like McKinsey, right? President McKinsey, and he was a big, I don't know, he's into protectionism, and that was way before Keynes. So, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, to us, it seems more like a neo-mercantilism. But I think, I don't know, there's some unity we have. And so, yeah, I mean, would be interested to hear your thoughts on that. I did also just want to say, on the question of class consciousness, it's not such a simple question. I do think on a more basic level, being conscious of something means, I don't know, you're like a conscious human. It means like you're conscious of being a person and you know that and you understand that and you understand what it means to be a person. And so if you apply that to class, being class conscious means being aware. I mean, if a worker is class conscious, it means being aware that you're a worker and being aware that you are part of the working class, which has a class interest, and being aware of that interest and being aware of the ultimate interest of that class. And a lot of people are not aware of that. And so I think to me, the question is, how do we ourselves understand what the general interest of the working class is? I don't know, it takes a lot of work to do that. And then how do we bring that understanding to people and try to show workers in a million different ways and not just be like, oh, well, Marx said this, so you should believe it. You know, like, you need to be pretty creative and pretty, not persistent, but like, I don't know, creative in how you bring those ideas to workers and how you convince them and how you make exposures in different ways. And so, yeah, I guess my question, what is my question? I guess my question is like how we do that today and kind of what that looks like given, I mean, on the one hand, the low level of the working class movement in the U.S., though there has been some notable upticks, which I think are important to see and very exciting. But given that, and then also given the disorganization on the left more broadly and disunity and how to bring those ideas to workers today.
Would you want to take a couple more questions before we throw it back to you?
Yeah.
Okay. And we've got a pretty long line here, which is great, but maybe let's try to keep our comments to like 2 to 3 minutes tops.
All right, I'll try. I wanted to like focus on one like dichotomy that comes up in your book, and I think you touched on in the talk, which is like the idea that, you know, in the era of globalization, there was the idea that, all the countries can grow and the developing world can catch up to the first world and, you know, the infinite growth can just be spread, right? And then now that's been replaced with the sort of, neo-mercantilist idea that, like, yeah, there's a zero-sum game and we're competing with China, we're competing with whatever. And it just seems like it keeps bouncing back between those two things, right? But it's not just capitalists and the leaders who keep bouncing between that. It's also the left is sort of finds itself being forced to defend either one position or the other. which is, you know, you see that in the fact that, you know, a lot of the sort of like social democratic left, you know, even like as represented within the Democratic Party, like Biden kept most of Trump's tariffs. You would find a lot of people who call themselves on the left being sort of either, you know, ambivalent or even sort of cautiously supportive of tariffs, right? And the idea that we need to help American workers and that we need to organize American workers. And, you know, this, like the panel that we were both just at before this, the kind of like social democratic Bernie wing of the left is very excited about the idea of like, you know, bringing back American industry, bringing back American workers, revitalizing the American family, whatever. And I guess the question for me is like, how do we keep from getting, how do we get out of this trap where we're forced into either one or the other? And, I mean, to me, your book has an answer to it, right? It suggests an answer, and it has to do with all the chapters on the the global declining rate of profit, and it's just like unfortunate because it's sort of to the extent that people even know about it, they know about it as this like obscure point of Marxist theory that's debated by nerds and academics and has no bearing on reality. But I wonder if you agree. Like, to me, this is the key point, because understanding that is how we get out of this, like, either the idea that we can just keep growing profits and build the welfare state from that, or that we have to defend specifically the national profits against all the other ones. Yeah, and I guess that's kind of I don't know. I wonder if you had thoughts on that.
Yeah. So the first question about neo-mercantilism and, like, again, class consciousness. I mean, yeah, I think that it is. It makes some sense to refer to what is happening now as a kind of neo-mercantilist moment, right? Like, classical mercantilism was all about the fetishization of gold, and like, you just have to export whatever it is that your country has, primary goods or whatever, and get more gold than the other country. Actually just get gold however you can. And that's how you build the wealth out of your country. And so, while obviously we're not on a gold standard anymore, it is still, as I think you both mentioned, right? It is still that zero sum calculus where, yeah, growth for one is coming at the expense of all others. And so yeah, I think it does make sense to call it neo-mercantilism in that way. And then I think you also mentioned the kind of the resurrection of Keynesian ideas and the very powerful role that it has played in the Democratic Party in particular. And that is definitely true. And it has taken a very nationalistic form. This sort of gets at what Alex's question. That, you know, basically, a lot of Keynesian economists are really smart, but like because they have kind of thrown their lot in with what the Biden administration did and was doing, they feel compelled to take up this argument that like everything bad happening, they make it more sophisticated ways, but they do argue that America's economy is declining, right, because China is exporting too many goods, too many manufactured goods all around the world, and they're competing unfairly or whatever. So they kind of adopt Keynesian ideas to this more belligerent kind of perception of the international trade arena. Class consciousness, I mean, I'm of course a Marxist. Like, I do think the falling rate of profit is important. I think all that shit is really important. But like, if I'm talking to ordinary people, I don't bring any of that stuff up. I don't talk about Marx. I don't talk about, I mean, I rarely say the word socialism. I'm usually trying to just, and I'm just talking about my personal approach, right? I'm usually trying to keep it at a much more sort of ground level vocabulary. And I just don't think, I think for building class consciousness toward a unified sense of like what's politically possible, we don't necessarily have to draw on the theoretical vocabulary to do that. It's very alienating a lot of the time. People don't know what you're talking about. And so I think it's like kind of, it's like a tightrope you have to walk between, you know, there is a real project of sort of class unification and clearing up of class consciousness. And that's very important for left politics. But I personally believe that like Marx has a lot of really important stuff to say about that. But I, in our everyday practice, I think it's not as useful to bring that stuff up explicitly. Yeah, left campism and taking national positions one against the other. I mean, yeah, I think I don't know if there's like a simple antidote to that problem, right? Like, I mean, if I take your question right, it was like, yeah, we have essentially the zero sum sort of mentality goes both ways because we have the ruling class sort of thinking in those terms and the right sort of thinking in terms of advancing American interests and the interests of American workers or whatever over workers in other parts of the world. But we also, like you were saying, we see the left, some parts of the left taking up that same narrative, right? This more like kind of chauvinist working class politics. And I mean, there's no, it's an extremely difficult problem because it's just, it's hard, it's inherently difficult to talk about international solidarity because it's something that seems so abstract, right? From everyday experience, it's hard to talk about it in a way that doesn't seem abstract and that doesn't seem like moralistic, right? Like you should care about the conditions that are affecting Chinese industrial workers, right? Just as much as workers here. But you can make an argument, you know, like that to someone here, and they might be like, yeah, that's true. But like also, you know, what about what Trump has been saying about how they've been, you know, kicking our ass for decades or whatever? You know, they're like a lot of people hear him when he makes those arguments. And so I think focusing on one way to approach it, at least, is, yeah, focusing on how that discourse of competition with workers in other countries will lead to the common ruin of both countries, of both working classes, right? If trade tensions continue to ratchet up between the U.S. and China, that's going in a direction that's going to be very bad for the workers of both countries. And I think if you come at it that way, like this is moving in a very dangerous direction, that has that can get through, right? Like people will hear you when you make that argument. Or at least I've had success making that argument with people before.
All right, let's try to cut this line in half.
You're playing some Doge.
like austerity. Okay.
Question time austerity. All right. Hi, Jamie. My question is really about, I think, what I see often is accompanying sort of the, what I see as like the economic and policy exhaustion that's at the center of this book are certain kind of, at least ostensibly non-economic phenomena that also speak to the same kind of emergent or resurgent Malthusianism and sort of zero-sum thinking. And I'm thinking here of like falling rates of birth, aging populations, or emerging resource scarcity, or the failure to sort of meaningfully meet any kind of carbon reduction goals, and despite decades of ostensible policy efforts. And so my question often that comes to my mind is like, to what degree are these causes, and what degree are they symptoms, and what is a useful framework for thinking about them vis-a-vis sort of the possibilities of the economic system that they are that they interact with. And particularly, I think it becomes more pressing as, you know, the right wing develops, at least to what to many people are compelling arguments for how we're going to combat them, whether, and usually by scapegoating the usual target. So my question for you is sort of, how do we understand that, those phenomena, whether it's cause versus symptom, and how do we combat those narratives?
Just go ahead. Hello. So my question was about, you talked earlier about the CHIPS Act, and a lot of that, so that's like their kind of, when I say they, the ruling class is sort of domestic industrial policy solution that they're trying to land on. But a lot of that is based on sort of investments and things like AI and unproven returns that, in my opinion, is something I do professionally, isn't going to materialize. It's just not there. And it's very speculative, all the value that's been created. So if and when something like that bottoms out, what do you think that looks like? And how is that different to like the bottoming out of, say, like 20th century industrial policy, where factories and stuff went overseas, where in this place you have data centers and chip fabs that really don't employ that many people? So like, how is that going to play out in a different way?
All right. So I was listening into what you were talking about as far as mass politics and what the left can do. I don't know whether this is good news or bad news. It's just news. I'm a university professor, so there's already problems there. It's all good. It's all good. I've had my fair share of arguing with the tenured faculty class about stuff there, you know, within the managerial thing. And we are 8 years into the Gramscian interregnum, and we're still wondering, you know, what to go and where to, you know, what to do here. There's two books that struck my mind here. There's one that was written many years ago by Thomas Frank. It's What's the Matter with Kansas, right? Which the answer is, there's nothing wrong with Kansas. We just don't understand why Kansas votes the way that they do. And there was a book that was published within the last year by Maria Snagovaya called When the Left Moves Right. And she talks about a lot of these right-wing politics in Europe, the Viktor Orbans and the Marine Le Pens, and how they end up becoming today's modern day left-wing policy groups, because they're the only ones that speak on behalf of the working classes. There is no classical Marxist movements within any of these countries. So I guess it's more, you can say whether it's a question or a point here to this, is that the right seems to be much more active at the grassroots level in organizing a large group of followers, not within ANCAP that we talked about, but within national conservatism. And within national conservatism, there is a large element of the working classes that are willing to, you know, cast their vote for the right simply because national conservatism speaks on behalf of working class values that the neoliberal elites don't. And so if we're going to talk about mass politics and what the left to do, you know, što delat, as, you know, Lenin asks, we need to think about what is the narrative. You mentioned before, you're a Marxist. I'm a doomer Marxist, right? You know? Yeah. And in that regard, I agree with you in the sense that we don't talk about Marxism per se. We don't talk about the S word, socialism per se. But I've had, ironically enough, many amazing conversations with unapologetic Trump voters who, at the end of the day, would vote for a Sanders, for a Corbyn, if they were available. I think that's the closest thing that we came in the United States was Bernie Sanders. The fact that the man took West Virginia in the primaries, and I was mentioning this to my academic colleagues, saying that's a major, major sign. You know what they said? But the working class, they're probably like anti-gay. So I'm like, what the hell? Who cares? You know? So I guess the role is that, you know, narrative is important, and how do we counter the narratives, right, of the right?
Sure. Well, a couple of things. First of all, the class consciousness thing, I think a lot, like, just from my profession, and, you know, I work in the environmental sciences, and how a lot of the environmental scientists are kind of scared of the new regime, because basically the Republicans want to wage a war against the declared war to the environmental agencies, which employ a lot of like meteorologists and people like that. One thing that I've been thinking about is that about building fighting capacity, because one thing sometimes I'm realizing is that it's almost like, for example, I see my peers, you know, and it's almost like they are just willing to take it, you know, like just kind of like, and I'm wondering about like, how do you make fighting the bosses great again, you know? So that's one. The second one about the rate of profit that you were saying was an academic subject. One thing that fascinates me about Trump winning is how much the world economy is thrown, you know? That Trump is good for the economy. So one thing that, and actually like the mainstream, you know, like mainstream economists have all these ideas of, well, we could kickstart the economic engine if we do this. And usually it's just looking back at the 20th century. You know, like they are very melancholic about the post-World War II. So I'm just gonna say, like, I think the rate of profit thing, like, it could be a good intervention if it's couched in those terms, because people care about the economy, and it's a very theoretical concept, you know? So everybody theorizes about the economy, everybody has a theory about the economy, but then it's, why can't it, because if the ruling class can kickstart the economy, to a lot of people, that's enough. You know, they're like, well, you know, it's just that they just need to do the right thing. And okay, that's it.
Appreciate it. So, yeah, the first question, I think it was Eric's question, the non-economic factors, right? Am I missing one? Okay, that was the first question. Short answer is I would see them as symptoms. Like, I think the demographic crisis that the right is constantly hammering home, and that now even some on the left are sort of taking up arms about, is rooted in the evolution of the labor market in this country and the way that has fundamentally, in a lot of ways, changed familial norms, gender relationships, has undermined patriarchal authority in some ways, and has destabilized as a result, has kind of destabilized the structures of the nuclear family. And that's partly the right's project, is to rejuvenate that, right? Like to restore that foundation of authority and kind of authoritarian control. And basically, I would argue that that is the outcome of the way that neoliberalism kind of played out and then spun out over the last several decades. The climate crisis, I think, is escalating. I think that one's more straightforward. I mean, that's just the the fossil fuel companies, you know, didn't give a shit. Now they talk about it, but there was way too much profits to be made in the carbon economy and in continuing to produce and extract carbon energy. And as long as there was a tremendous amount of money to be made, the corporate executives didn't care about climate change. The politicians didn't care about climate change. And so, I mean, I think it's class power, basically, that's driving the climate crisis. So I would also argue that's a symptom as well. The AI crash, I mean, the question is, like, how bad is it going to be? You know, not if, but when. And it's looking right now that, I mean, it's going to be pretty dramatic when the bottom falls out. Who was asking this question, by the way? But it's going to look very, it's probably going to be quite dramatic when all these assets, I mean, everyone knows they're extremely, like, ridiculously overvalued, and that the profits really are not going to be coming forthcoming in the future to the degree that they're supposed to be. And so my best guess is this thing has maybe another year to run or so. Investors are already very skeptical about it. And every day you read some news story about, like, Sam Altman or some other asshole getting more and more desperate and trying to fabricating extravagant stories to try to hype it up more. So that's not even getting into how the trade wars and the trade conflicts are disrupting, right, the market for chips and for semiconductors and for all of that. And so it will be different from the Great Depression, yeah, because these industries are much less labor intensive. And very often it's like a factory with a huge like robotic line, you know, and a control room with like a handful of engineers just like pressing buttons. That's like what a modern semiconductor factory looks like. And so it will be, I think, devastating for corporate profits and for financial asset values. I don't know. We'll have to see how much that ripples out into the broader kind of labor market. Like more generally, the pro Sanders Trumper. Yeah. So what's the matter with Kansas when the left moves right and national conservatism and the, how some sort of Trump supporters are amenable to the Sanders argument and countering the narrative. Yeah. I mean, I think this is again, like, a matter of crafting a narrative that, like, moves people affectively and emotionally in the way that, like, Trump's language does. And I think, like, Sanders got part of that right. You know, he had the anger, he had the performance, but, like, it just didn't come through at the end of the day as credible enough to bring out the majorities that we needed. And so it has to be a message of class war against whether we want to call it the billionaire class, the corporate class, the bosses, as Amir was saying. Like, we need that demon, right? Like the personification of evil in our narrative, the same way the right demonizes their enemies. You know, we need enemies too. Like, our left-wing narrative needs an easily identifiable enemy at which to direct the energy. And so I think that's something that we have to figure out narratively. Yeah, I would just say to Amir, how to make fighting bosses great again. Like, I think this is part of that, right? Like, how we come up with a narrative that's going to be compelling and that is going to center economic power at the workplace as a central, like, node of it, right? I think there's a lot of different ways we can think about that, but I think that's again going to be a kind of collective process of all of us and like-minded people figuring out how to speak that narrative. Yeah, I think that's it for this.
Jamie's got all the answers.
Hey, so my first question is about this tendency of the rate of profit to fall. I'm wondering to what extent, I mean, you're sort of saying capitalism is in this big crisis, you know, unforeseen. And, you know, we look at, like, the Great Depression and people were saying, oh, it's the end of capitalism. People said it in the 70s. And so, yeah, I guess my understanding of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall is somewhat incomplete, but the basic idea being that you have a deep, more hard industry and investment that, like, you understand, okay, what is actually causing profit? It's the surplus of labor time of the workers, and so if you have, like, higher industry, like, greater industry with, like, less workers, then you have this tendency of the rate of profit to fall. I mean, here, I guess one thing that I'm struggling with is the aspect of, like you would talk about the imperialist competition, but also the aspect of outshoring of production. You have, you know, you do actually have pretty labor intensive production internationally, and so that rate of profit is falling. But you know, is that a unique thing? And then how do you sort of reconcile the fact that we actually do have labor intensive production? You know, actually in China, and that's why, you know, they want to bring that production out of China back to the U.S. or into the countries that the U.S. is friendly with, that they can count on. But so yeah, that's one question. In terms of the discussion on class consciousness, yeah, I think it's something I've grappled with for a long time, and I've over time changed my position on the question of should we, you know, talk about socialism. I used to work at Amazon for 3 years and kind of came in and was like a bit tentative and had these similar ideas around, you know, want to be too jargony, you know, what are people really going to understand? But realized over time that, yeah, similar to as someone brought up, there is a deep hunger among the working class to understand the economy, and not just to understand it in a cursory way, but you know, among especially the most advanced workers, to really understand what's going on. And I think, you know, we ask this question of how to build a mass movement, you know, a class based on the aspect of class war, the need to bring the working class and their political interests to the highest point, which is, you know, socialism and communism. And if we want a movement to do that, how can we do that if we're afraid to talk about socialism and afraid to explain things to people? So yeah, that's my question. I think there's a need for all of us to be a bit more, confident in our politics and in our understanding that people do want to take these ideas up.
Hi, I had a question about a concept that you talked about. Is it state capitalism or stake capitalism? State capitalism, and I think you defined it as private corporations' reliance on the state to enforce policy. Is that correct?
Like becoming, I mean, very generally, becoming more dependent on government intervention in order to function. Yeah.
Government intervention, as far as enacting a policy or direct, like
policies, administrative stuff, like bailouts, you know, regulations that keep the financial sector afloat, labor market policies, like, you know, attacking unions and working class organizations, like all of that is part of state capitalism.
Is that not different from what we're already currently experiencing now in this society?
Well, what do you mean now? I'm saying now that's intensifying.
Oh, it's intensifying. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So is there like a differentiation between just calling it state capitalism versus imperialism?
Yeah, because I think if you talk about imperialism, that doesn't necessarily get at how the private, like, market-led economy is becoming increasingly obsolete, and the kind of classic liberal ideas of competitiveness and efficiency, market efficiency, and letting the market take the lead, because that leads, I mean, foundational ideas for capitalism, right, for liberal, like, civilization. Just using the word imperialism doesn't get at how those foundational ideas of market efficiency and competition are becoming less and less believable. The elites themselves are taking them less and less seriously. You know, they show by their actions. Again, with the turn towards industrial policy and these kinds of stronger state-directed economic interventions. So that's why I use that term.
Interesting. All right. I also realized I took the mic.
That's okay.
Thank you. Interested in stake capitalism myself. I have a very brief and precise question, but first I want to throw in my two cents about building a mass movement. I think something that often gets underrated is class confidence when we're talking to people who aren't that familiar with socialism. Something I've run into canvassing for socialist candidates is people just have not seen any of this work out in their lives. It just sounds nice, but there's no tangible relation to them in any way you can build that. Doesn't have to be through reforms, but I think that's a key thing. That being said, Bretton Woods institutions, I wanted to ask about them. If you look back, you know, 20, 25 years ago, the left was talking a lot more about them and we're not now. And I think the reason for that is probably because especially WTO is like not really setting the agenda anymore. It's just kind of irrelevant, often ignored. So wondering when you think that shift sort of happened and if there's a possibility that countries are going to desire a return to kind of rulemaking and dealing with disputes, or if we're totally in a new paradigm and if it's a worse one than what people were protesting in Seattle back in the day.
I'll keep it super brief. I guess my question is, what do you feel is next? A lot of great ideas were brought up tonight, and they kind of remind me a lot of Naomi Klein's shock doctrine, in which is the idea that many shocks, like natural disasters, which will probably tragically keep continuing and intensify, things like COVID, wars, are taken advantage of by, let's just say, like the ruling elite class. I was just wondering how you felt. Someone mentioned anti-fragility. How much more do we have left? How much more do we have left in us? Is there any more to this rubber band? How you're feeling about it and what comes next? Does something come after capitalism?
Yeah. The first question, about the falling rate of profit, that and the kind of persistence of labor-intensive production, et cetera. I mean, it's interesting, like, if you look at the recent economic history of China, right, over the last couple decades, it's been described as the workshop of the world. They've been undergoing their own process of deindustrialization, in which the old sort of industrial heartland of the Northeast has increasingly been hollowed out and kind of devastated by that same process of disinvestment and obsolete industrial work that has devastated the Midwest of this country and other parts of it. And so they're experiencing the same things that this country and others are experiencing. And in fact, in China, it's almost as if they're going through the development has been so rapid that it's like they're going through what the just quote unquote, like the global North, like the Western countries, the industrial countries. It took us like 300 something years to go through this process. They've been going through it in like 30 years. And that, of course, has profound implications for what the leadership in that country is going to do, what the working class there is going to do in response. But what the Bidenists and the Trumpists want to do with this whole onshoring idea, it's even if they, whatever success they have building new factories, reshoring industrial production here, it's going to be like a fraction of the number of workers employed. You know, like they have this, in my view, very foolish notion that it's going to be like the 1950s again or the 1960s, where like these very capital intensive and labor intensive factories are going to be super high productivity, that it's going to allow corporate profits to go up along with workers' wages. So incomes and profits are going to rise simultaneously, and it's going to create rising living standards, right? And that's how they're going to get out of this mess they're in, right? This rapidly deteriorating domestic situation. But the number of jobs they're going to create is like a rounding error of a rounding error. Like it's nothing. And it's going to be for like a more specialized segment of the workforce. Like I was saying earlier, mostly like sort of engineering anyway. And so it's, while there remain, of course, like you were saying, labor intensive, production still, around the world, deindustrialization is still happening, it's picking up pace, even in the countries in which, labor intensive factory production has moved over from here. And so that's when, in my opinion, when Marx talks about falling rate of profit, the other side of that is what he calls the rising organic composition of capital, in which you have more and more non-labor investments creating production and being exchanged for profit, less and less labor, that's creating less and less surplus value. And basically, the argument I make in the book is that this process of global deindustrialization is happening, and that's happening because the rate of profit is falling, and those forms of investment become less and less profitable over time as market competition intensifies globally. And so, anyway, there's a lot more to be said about that. I hope it sort of gets at least a little bit of your question. Oh yeah, and also your question or your point about using language of socialism and capitalism to talk to people, that's well taken. You know, I think like my instinct is still just the tradition I was trained in, you know, as an organizer is like you downplay that stuff and you just talk about kind of bread and butter issues. That's how you connect with people. But we do have to keep in mind that, like, you know, our society is getting worse all the time and it's making people angrier and angrier all the time. And maybe soon it's time to just start talking about capitalism. You know, like the system itself is capitalism, name it as such. It's based on a class divide between the workers and the ruling class. And maybe we just start talking about that more openly. You know, maybe you're right about that. Like, that's totally fair. The Bretton Woods institutions, I mean, they're hopeless, man. Like whoever had that question, you know, I mean, like the WTO, like the US, that's the US's institution, right? Like bespoke global institution that was like the crowning achievement of the neoliberal world economy. And now it's China filing all of these suits against the US in the World Trade Organization for all of our coercive, you know, trade, like export restrictions and trade restrictions against them and other countries. And so the US, like now we're the ones blocking the WTO from doing its job because, you know, it's not in our interests anymore. And I think the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, I used to have to entertain some like sense that might be possible for us to, you know, if we were to win the presidency with someone like Sanders, we could maybe work through some of these institutions to like redirect capital to the global south and resources to the global south and to other parts, like other countries that are desperately starved of capital, and leverage the institutions to carry out that sort of program of global investment. But there's just, yeah, they're not our institutions. We don't have the power anyway to get there. And they're pretty much fucked anyway. What is next after cap? Was your question, what is after capitalism? What was that? Whoever was asking that question, basically. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, right now it's looking like barbarism, right? Socialism or barbarism. And right now it's definitely, as it usually has been, right? Looking more like the barbarism side of the ledger is the direction things are going in. But, you know, the best we can do is, in my opinion, try to learn from the past, learn from the failures of left organizations in the past, what didn't work, what did work, and try to pick up the pieces to assemble something that's going to be appropriate for the moment that we're in. And whether that gets us to some kind of, you know, post-capitalist society, whatever, we can table that for now, I think, maybe, in my opinion. And because I think we have some very practical questions about organization and class consolidation, basically. But there's a lot more, obviously, to be said about that. That was the last one.
All right, so we can do another round, maybe two, of questions. And while these questions are being asked, I'm going to put up this QR code we had up before. This is a QR code for a discounted copy of Jamie's book. He was hoping to have some today, but he doesn't have them. So you can scan that QR code and get a discounted. What's the discount? 70%? All right. Maybe not 70, but you'll have to see for yourselves. You might win a free book if you scan that QR code.
Thanks for taking the time. I just want to say, Path of Praxis, really happy to have you here. My question is regards to non-terrestrial matters. The current hearing on the UAPs that just happened, you know, it's like I just want to get down to the nitty-gritty. Economically, there's a lot of hidden funds that haven't been disclosed. Like, where is the money? Both left and the right are asking, where are these billions that have been lost and unaccounted for in the recent budget that's, you know, we're still trying to figure out? When all of those accounting and disclosures informations come to this to the surface, what's your end game paradigm towards this global post-globalized possibly non-human society that we're gonna possibly experience? What's your take on the UAP meetings and in regards to the world economy and oh, the alien stuff, bro. My bad. It's just very pressing to me. You know, it is relevant.
Okay, so this is probably just because we came from a different event where, you know, a number of good people, but a lot of people who seem to be stuck still in the 2016, 2020 moment of Sanders and wanting to return to a kind of Scandinavian-style welfare state. This is very much in the air around the same time as Trump was kind of picking up steam. And it's been in the air really since Syriza with Tsipras and Podemos and then Sanders and Corbyn. Why in your vision of the way that the world economy is tending, why is that perhaps untenable? And then second of all, and perhaps this has been obviated by the fact that of inflation, like you had a lot of stuff like 3-4 years ago about like sort of left MMT stuff that I know you've written about. I don't hear so much about that anymore, but like, why are these kinds of solutions being floated on the left as a kind of response to the kind of trends that you investigate in your book?
Hello, Mr. Merchant. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us. My question is about a less interesting type of alien, non-citizens. And so one of the major shifts maybe between what you call the globalization era and whatever we're in now is a huge market intensification of anti-immigration, anti-refugee, anti-migrant, anti-alien attitudes, not only on the American right, but also on the American liberal centrist, our idea of, or not maybe our idea, but what the U.S. considers the left. And nowadays, with Trump coming in for his second round, there is talk of mass deportation. This is a big thing with the right populists. Their solution to the problems of our day. So two quick observations, and then I want to see your response to them. One is that there's no way that Trump could pull off a mass deportation without massive reliance on international partners. You can't just ship people back to their country. You'd have to go through a huge, years-long, decades-long diplomatic back and forth just to pull off one deportation. It's a long process. And then two, there's no way that you can pull off a mass deportation without relying on states. The federal government can't do it unless we want to plunge ourselves into $1 trillion debt. And so this will require not just a federal, national-level effort, but a state-level effort. And so my question, in light of those two observations, is those seem to me to be two inflection points or two, nodes of possible resistance, the international front and the local state or municipal front. And so what do you think is the role of the left, or what's the capacity of the left to intervene on those two levels, internationally and statewide?
Yeah, the first question, resurrecting social democracy, national social democracy, and the way it looks. I mean, the idea is that we're going to be able to somehow get back again, as we've referenced in previous comments here, to a kind of a form of economic growth that was central to the era of what people now see as the most successful period of capitalism after the Second World War, in which growth rates were comparatively good compared to where they are now. And, there was a much more well-organized labor movement and, in fact, a big crisis in the 70s was a very militant period in terms of working class power and kind of pushing the envelope in terms of confrontation with the ruling class. But whenever people on the right or left or whatever throw around this idea of resurrecting national social democracy, they almost never sort of get into that question of like, what was the economic form of life that made that possible? And it was this labor-intensive, like industrial form of production and profit that I was talking about earlier that employed, tens of millions of people and paid a wage that could support a family or at least for some period of time. And even though that's a whole ideology of its own now, the family wage, and that now is seen as kind of, again, like the source of this like yearning for the nuclear family and for, and for industry to come back to this country. And so there's never any kind of at least when I see this argument presented, no one digs into like the history about like, okay, well, how did we get into this present like deindustrialized economy? What was it that's driving that process? What is it that continues to drive that process? Like, how much control over that do the policy elite actually have? Can they just create a new Fordist, like, post-war industrial economy out of what they have now, the resources they have now. It doesn't make sense because it's not profitable enough. It wouldn't be as profitable as it was. In fact, it wouldn't be profitable at all to build those kinds of those forms of production that were the norm back then. And so it typically just takes the form of this nice abstract idea that because we think back to this golden era when unions were stronger and, like, you know, class militancy was better, we can just, like, do that over again. Like, we can run capitalism in reverse, basically, you know, and they're like, we're going to have a nice, tidy family again, and, like, where the male breadwinner is going to be the patriarch, and everything's going to be nice and stratified. And, like, I just rarely see, like, an engagement with those kinds of historical questions among the people who make this kind of argument. MMT has, in my opinion, just been rendered irrelevant by history. You know, no one cares about it really anymore in policy circles. I think the inflation spike, the inflation wave, really kind of took it out of fashion. It was very popular during the time of, like, very low interest rates, when it was people thought it was plausible to make the argument that whatever, the government can spend as much as it wants. It prints the money anyway. So why can't it just print as much money as it needs, employ everybody? Say what? The money machine go burr. Yeah. And if it borrows, it's not going to have to pay any, you know, barely any interest on that anyway. Now interest rates are much higher. The federal budget deficit is, like, exploding, and it's going to get even bigger in the coming years. And so, like, the amount of interest that, like, the government is going to be paying on its debt in the coming years is going to be, like, eclipsing. It's going to be, like, as big as the military, as, like, the Pentagon's budget. That's how big it's going to be. And then it's going to be bigger, like, the following decade. So, like, you know, the ruling class is not happy about this because they're fiscal hawks at the end of the day. And they and the politicians do, at the end of the day, will mostly do their bidding. And so that's basically, I think, yeah, that's the fate of MMT. I don't think it's going to be relevant going forward. Yeah, Jordan's question about immigration and the kind of international scope of the deportation program and the possibilities for confronting that. I mean, international solidarity is the hardest piece of the puzzle, in my opinion. I mean, I've worked on a number of issues that have tried to build bridges of solidarity between, like, workers here and workers in other parts of the world, and it's very hard. In my experience, we haven't had much success kind of coordinating work here with the stuff that, you know, working class organizations are doing here with what's happening among workers in other countries. But it doesn't mean it can't be done. It just means it's really hard. And there are some signs of hope. Like, I know the United Auto Workers are serious about trying to push harder for stronger, like, labor rights built into trade agreements between, like, for example, Mexico and the U.S. because they're beginning to make the argument publicly that they want, you know, Mexican workers' wages to be competitive with U.S. workers' wages, so that those jobs, whatever, those companies will find it as worthwhile to invest here as it is to invest in Mexico. But, like, that kind of boilerplate language around labor is always in trade agreements, very often, you know, in international trade agreements, and it very rarely goes anywhere. But we'll see. We're moving into this new kind of Cold War moment where, because there is going to be this competitive dynamic between China and the U.S. might be looking to cut deals with other countries that it wouldn't otherwise be, you know, amenable to, in order to build prestige and power and to try to undercut China. And so perhaps maybe that's one window into an international connection on the immigration question. But yeah, that's a tough nut to crack. I'd be interested to hear what you think about that.
Aliens. Oh yeah, aliens. Yeah. Yeah. So I didn't listen to the most recent UAP hearings because I assume they're just like the last 20 of them where you get like a Pentagon insider type person saying like, oh, I saw some crazy stuff in there. We should really investigate it and, you know, move more funding towards these sections of the Pentagon that are involved in this UAP research. I don't think there's anything there. I've looked at one of the major groups involved in this, which was To the Stars Academy, CEO Tom DeLonge of one of my favorite bands, Blink-182. And everything that he's talking about doing with this Pentagon funding is total bullshit. I know a bit about this because I wrote a book a couple years ago called I Wanna Believe, which is about UFOs and communism and like this kind of positive vision of first contact. One of the groups that I talked about was writing around the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall about how there was going to be this enemy alien propaganda where now that we don't have the USSR as our big enemy, people from the military are going to say that aliens are going to come and invade Independence Day style, and we're going to need a lot of funding to fight them. So I think when we hear about this UAP stuff, I mean, the Pentagon has plenty of money, but it's different factions of the Pentagon trying to get money. And what they're using the money for is often weapons. Often it's just giving money away to new space age billionaires like Robert Bigelow, who's part of To the Stars Academy. He's like a competitor of Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos and these industries. So, yeah, I think it's all fake. Sorry. You got another question?
Yeah, so at the top, you talk about the... at the top of your original speech, you're talking about kind of the absence of any sort of like hashtag resistance by the liberals. And you even see things, you know, like Morning Joe going to Mar-a-Lago to, you know, as you put it, have tea with Donald Trump. So I was wondering, like, you know, I think the resistance among the liberals from the 2016 to 2020 period, you know, that captured a lot of energy, a lot of anti-Trump energy, you know, very effectively. And as, I mean, you know, it's only been a couple weeks since the election, so a lot of things can still happen. But if this current trend continues where liberals are going to keep sitting on their hands or even, you know, capitulate to Trump on certain things, you know, do you see the failure of the liberals to capture the anti-Trump sentiment as an opening for people on the left in terms of getting organized and you know, maybe capturing that energy on the left? Yeah, I mean, you also do see factions of the Democratic Party who read the election, I think correctly, as a failure of, you know, a failure by Kamala Harris to not lean into economic populism. So... you know, there's another possibility that the Democratic Party will learn from that mistake and lean more into it, in which case they could, you know, capture kind of like socialist curious people. So I'm just wondering your take on that dynamic.
So maybe one more question before we do our closing thoughts.
Should the new big tent be an anti-war big tent?
We forgot about anti-war. Good question.
Yeah, I mean, I would just answer that immediately and say yeah. And I mean, I think the like rekindling the anti-war movement is going to be really essential in the coming years. And I think the student protesters in this country and in that protest movement that erupted last spring, I think they reignited the anti-war movement and an international perspective in a way that that hasn't been really present in a mainstream way in a long time. And of course, they were attacked viciously for it, but. The wars, I mean, I suspect the wars are not going to go away, and they're probably going to be just getting worse, and new ones are probably coming. And so I think that's going to be absolutely essential, yeah. Tying an anti-war message to whatever it is that we're doing locally, domestically, nationally is going to be really, really crucial. And that sort of ties into the first part of the question. I mean, the Democrats and what's happening with them, they're already drawing all the wrong lessons from this. And some are kind of like, you know, pointing to the very slim margins of Republican victory in like the swings in some of the swing states as like, well, look, maybe if we had just been more economically populist or something, or if Harris had just gone in harder on like the economic populist language, we could have won all these swing states. And then Trump wouldn't be president. And it's like, yeah, okay, it's a counterfactual. We don't know for sure. But they've shown zero interest in doing that, and it's very hard to see like the direction things are going and the kind of narrative that's coalescing and who they're blaming for it, and I sort of mentioned earlier, I think sections of the party are now they're prepared to normalize Trump in some way, right? That outrage isn't there, the resistance isn't there. And it's not like 2016 when they could just pretend he was an aberration. You know, he's this anti-democratic, like intruding force from outside, right? That isn't American or whatever, as Biden would say over and over again. No, they can't pretend he's an anomaly anymore. And so, yeah, I think that's going to have very toxic effects on the party strategy, to put it mildly. But as you also mentioned in part of your question, that does create an opening for us, for people like us. And because there's going to be a vacuum there to take up the energy and the anger and to speak to people's fears and anxieties, you know, about what's coming, and to do so with a compellingly left-wing vision that goes beyond what the resistance moment of 2017 was, and but nevertheless still ideally like mobilizes and activates huge numbers of people like that moment, and then keep just as important, you know, keeps them activated, you know, keeps them organized, and which was not the case in 2017 for sure. That's what I have to say about that.
That's the problem the left seems to have. Like, there's all these like big sparks, often mediated by social media, you know, and they're like nothing sticks, and that's very interesting to me.
Well, along those lines, I think there are networks who have stuck around from the early days of the resistance, and they tend to be the people who are directly under the gun. There was no massive feminist movement that could to prevent the bans on abortion that we've seen, but there are those networks of people who share abortion medication and do things along those lines. And some of the groups that I was involved in that were trying to do ICE watch and prevent deportation raids and that sort of thing weren't really able to stay mobilized and stay active. But people in those communities were, and they have their own networks. In 2006, we saw arguably the biggest general strike in the history of the United States, which was immigrant workers taking May Day off by the millions. So those networks existed then. We'll see if they exist now. We haven't really seen that kind of mobilization in a while. A lot of trans and queer people are mobilizing right now in various ways, understanding the kind of repression that might be coming. Some of the repression against the left that Trump people want to do, we've already seen it mobilize against Stop Cop City people and the pro-Palestinian movement. So what I'm trying to get at is that the resistance I think we're going to see over the next couple of years is going to come from the people who are directly affected. You know, there's going to come from activists as well, but it's going to be most effective from the people who are directly affected. So we've got to pay attention, and it's going to be difficult to pay attention to, for example, undocumented people who are going to have to resist in very subtle ways for the most part, at least initially. There's a real blind spot for those people working in agriculture, for example, for people working in service work. Leads me to some of my thoughts about the concept of class consciousness, which is it's not this consciousness that we have, or like the academics have, that the people who read Marx have, but it's the people who are workers. Working people have, they're not automatons. They have consciousness. They know what it means to do their job, and they know what it means to struggle with their coworkers in one way or another, even if they're not unionized, or just to struggle on their own if they're totally atomized. And so the challenge is to try to merge these consciousnesses together, to try to build links, to try to make that consciousness something bigger than your individual experience, whatever that might be. And understanding that the basis of a real resistance, of something that become bigger than a resistance, of power amongst working class people, as much as we want to fight for one another, you know, this is a noble ideal, ultimately people are going to fight the hardest when it's for their own lives and it's for the people that they care about. And so I think that's where we have to begin, because that's where we're at. All right, so we can close it out there, and everyone's welcome to hang out and talk some more and enjoy some food and drinks. Thanks a lot for coming, everybody, and thanks to Jamie Merchant.
Soon come the day this tender boss is gonna blow in your face, your face, your face. But I don't have the gift of the prophecy, telling everybody how it's gonna be. You go passing wrong for right and right for wrong. People only stand for that for just so long.